We hope no one would consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnava.org, brand new website, bluechipspeakersnava.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And we must have Dick Anderson come to the podium.
My name is Dick Anderson. I'm an alcoholic. And tonight I'm a grateful alcoholic. I appreciate the work that Tim does. I thought he'd been sober for much longer than he has because I see him working all the time. But I will tell you something I learned early on in the program. If you're working all the time doing things for other people, you'll be here and you'll be sober and you'll develop a lot of friends and your life will change. And I know other people that come here and keep waiting for something good to happen but don't do much and nothing happens. This program is something where we start to give other people of our lives, and our lives get better. That happened to me here in Atlanta, Georgia, on June the 8th, 1977. And I was smaller. I was actually taller, but I was... I've lost about an inch and a half, but I was smaller in other ways. I had hair. It was black, so... That's the good news for you young guys out there. If you stay sober long enough, you may look like me. And but I will tell you that I was absolutely lost when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew about it because people had messages on TV late at night. And it was always the same thing. If you like to drink, that's your business. If you'd like to stop, that's our business. And they had a thing that said Alcoholics Anonymous. And in those days, Alcoholics Anonymous was new. Not everybody knew about it. And so there'd be these, every once in a while in the interview, when they would have the Atlanta Roundup like they did. Now, I got sober the year that the Atlanta Roundup started. And but when there were other conferences, like the state conference, they would interview people and they would have them blacked out so you'd only see their silhouette. But you'd hear about this because it was such a miracle that an alcoholic could actually get sober. And today, because... You know, everybody knows about AA, or most people do. We take it for granted. But then it was like the cure to cancer. And so I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous before I got here. Some guy came and spoke to a bunch of us who had just gotten back from Vietnam. And we were sitting, two of us in the back, a gunny. It was my drinking buddy and me. And then we had all the newbies down front. And it was a mandatory drug abuse seminar. And the guy got up and says, my name is Charles, and I'm an alcoholic, but I don't drink anymore because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd come out to give a bunch of us guys a chance. Now, my buddy had suggested before we go to this mandatory drug abuse seminar that we have a couple of shooters, and he also did a roach, which I didn't do drugs. I felt like you lacked self-discipline if you did drugs. And so so we were in the back with our sunglasses on, back from the NOM and kind of high. But do you know that everything that that guy said sunk in here? When he started speaking, I heard exactly what he said. So if you go and you do DUI schools where they don't give you a standing ovation when you're through or you're doing other things outside speaking, the reason we do that is we save lives. And a lot of that kind of work has entered around Atlanta, especially around NAVA. NAVA has always been a solid foundation for sobriety here. When I first got sober, one of the guys, a guy named Joe Hubbard, who was one of the old guys, there were all these guys who got sober in the 40s and 50s, and they would go downstairs, and downstairs was a place everybody went for breakfast and lunch. They had a hot plate there. And I know they do that on special occasions, but they don't do it every day now, do they? Saturdays. But this is where you went every day, and it was kind of a good old boys club down there. These guys got sober in the 40s and 50s, and it was Joe Fallon and Joe Hubbard and Bill Root, who just passed away recently. And these are the people that helped build my life back. I come from a family that does not. And I wanted to thank a couple of people. Johnny, who was from my home group, Macklin, is kind of the anchor of our group. He's one of those guys that does all the work, just like Larry does. And they're getting to know each other. But if you see the people that are doing all the work, they're the ones you want to go and ask the questions for. Because if they have figured out that working and helping others is the key, that's somebody you want to be around. And these are the guys that are here. And there are more than two of them. There are a bunch of them that I see. Anyway, I came from a family that didn't have a lot of alcoholism in it, and in fact, I was the first alcoholic of record. I was not somebody that would have been a good candidate for an AA meeting, according to my family. That's not something I aspired to. My dad would have a drink now and then. They weren't teetotalers. But we come from a family of honor, not a family of wealth, but a family of honor. And I was always told I came from good stock. My dad was very humble. So were most of the people in our family. They didn't brag about who we were. It wasn't until later that I found out what good stock we came from. But it's a military family. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, the first one was born here, was Captain Dick Anderson, who commanded the first boat across the Delaware on Christmas Day. He later became a general at Valley Forge. His grandson was my great-grandfather, and his grandson was a three-star Richard Heron Anderson, who was a general at Gettysburg. My little sister's a retired Burke Colonel. Her husband's a retired Burke Colonel. Their boy graduated from West Point, blah, blah, blah. And that's the family that I grew up in, all of these military heroes. And then there's me. And the best way to describe me, I'm kind of like Forrest Gump in Lieutenant Dan's family. Except without the focus or the integrity. So, and that was me. I grew up always pretending to be somebody because I didn't feel like I fit in. And that was the one thing I had in common with people when I first got here. Defiance and feeling like I didn't fit in. I did not fit in with my family because they did what they did naturally. They didn't go to they weren't at the VFW to brag about things. None. My dad, if he went somewhere, it was to help somebody. You know, I joined the VFW because you could always get a drink in a dry county. And if you're getting ready to have a slip, that's useful information if you're a vet. So that's why, I mean, everything I did was to tell somebody, to lie about what I did, to make up things about what I did. And because I never did feel like I was enough. And that's the family I grew up in. So I felt estranged from people from the very beginning. Everything I was a member of was something that taught me the same principles we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a member of Boy Scouts, YMCA, Little League. 4-H, Boy Scouts Handbook says that the way we please God best is by doing something anonymously for another person each day. That's exactly what we do here. But I didn't get it. I did not get it there. We went to Bible school and church. I didn't get it there. I felt separated. There was something that was invented when I was growing up in the 50s, and it was a little box that had pictures on it, a little staticky, but it was called television. And up until then, I'd only been able to read books. Now this TV comes out, and it's magic. These people are there. And strangely, I didn't feel like I was really there in real life, because I didn't tell you who I was. But in TV, I could be just like them, and so that became the place that I went. And they actually had good moral teaching, too. It was Andy Griffith, the Leave It to Beaver, the Father Knows Best. And in those shows, they became my moral compass. If Wally or Opie ever got off the beam some way, by the end of the show, Dad had said something without judgment, and he had taken his pipe, turned it sideways. They got the message, and by the end of the show, Opie and Wally were back on the beam, and that became the place I would take my problems. I knew how to handle things because of what I saw there. So, I felt absolutely like I fit in when I was in that room with those people on that television screen. But then I would walk out of there and I would feel ill at ease with you again. I had my first spiritual experience when I was about 6 or 7. I went to the drive-in theater. This is in Louisville, Kentucky, our hometown. And there was a movie up there. The big book says this: lack of power is our dilemma. And while most of us can't express that, it's like feeling like I don't have the power to really deal with life, so I have to hide out from it or escape it. So I take a drink. Up there on the screen was the kind of power that I had always wanted. I had never seen television was in black and white then. This was something that was in color, not only color, but technicolor. And it was about 110 feet wide. And there was the kind of power that I absolutely wanted. There was a man up there with a staff. He would turn it to one side, and the Red Sea would part. And his name was Moses, and the movie was called The Ten Commandments. And that night I made two decisions. One, I want to be around whatever that is, film. And I have either made a living or not made a living, but that's what I've done for the last 4 years, is write and produce. The second decision I made was that I wanted to be on God's side, because in my little mind, what was wrong with me, I knew my parents and everybody in our family were faithful. They weren't talking about church every minute, but they believed in God, and they were prayerful, and they were humble. And so I thought, that's what's missing in my life. So the next day, much to the surprise of my parents, who did not know I was having a spiritual awakening in the back of the 55 Ford at the East Drive-In, I went down the aisle and got dipped and dunked at Linden Baptist Church. They were singing, "We Surrender All," and that's what I surrendered, all 3 feet of me, and I went down. I had this emotional experience, you know, have the experience, and you know you've just connected with God. Now everything is going to be wonderful. And it's like newcomers who come to AA and get that pink cloud for a while, then they find out, oops, that was just the introduction part. Now I've actually got to work. And then they leave, and they don't get it. And it's up to us to help them stay here if we can, but that's the way I was. So I, after a few days, weeks, whatever it was, when I didn't change because I wasn't taking any steps to change, and they didn't have any sponsors for, you know, 6-year-olds at Linda Baptist Church, so I ended up thinking that something was wrong with me. And there was this, I'm a thinker, so there was this loophole says, you know, that they are the chosen ones. So I figured out, God may like you because I see you smiling in church and I see you happy, but he doesn't like me. I surrendered all. I went down the aisle. I got dipped and dunked. I did the whole thing, and I'm still the scared little Baptist Boy Scout. So I made a decision. God didn't want me. So now I'm at odds with God, and I'm at odds with people. I don't fit in either one, and I don't particularly like to sit around living in nature either, so I was really in a bad place. The next spiritual experience I have, I was 14 years old. Now, I was doing it. They say, fake it till you make it. That's what I didn't realize. I was faking till I make it, acting like I appreciated everything. I made good grades, was good in sports, all that. Had a few people I associated with, but I wouldn't call them friends because I didn't know how to be intimate with anybody. And my next experience, I was 14 years old, and we were playing Babe Ruth League baseball, and I played center field. The left fielder got a six-pack of beer and a half a pint of gin. He drank the beer and I drank the gin. And I have the same experience that I imagine Moses must have felt when he was up there and the wind was blowing through his hair and he had the Red Sea parted, because suddenly I was about 6.5 feet tall and I felt no fear and it just dropped. And everything I'd been looking for in life had just happened. And I didn't get sick the first time I drank. All I got was that tremendous feeling. And from the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk. And going to town when you're 14 means hitchhiking. This is Louisville. We hitchhiked to a place called the White Castle, which, for those of you who don't know what it is, it's kind of like a downscale version of the Crystal. But it's where you go at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're drunk and you want to get those little patties that have 18 million onions on them that you think are a good idea at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're drunk, but not so much the next day. So we go in there. And I had always been very awkward, especially around adults. But there are all these adults in there. And back in those days, adults dressed very differently. Larry and I were just talking about, this is the first time I've done much speaking without a tie because, for one, Roop died, so he can't criticize me now. But anyway, but the thing is that we always wore ties to the podium, but I've started at local meetings sometimes wearing a shirt. But all adults wore a coat and tie, had a hat, pipe, all this kind of stuff, so they dressed very differently than us kids. So they were all in there, and that night I discovered table hopping. I was bouncing around and talking to them, introducing myself. You know, we had a lot in common. I was 14, they were 40. And so I was flirting with the redhead that was behind the counter, and I thought something was going on there, you know. And so my buddy Dave was not having the same spiritual experience I am. Dave was starting to get a little woozy. And so I had never had a cup of coffee either, but I had seen in Perry Mason where if you have too much to drink, you have a cup of coffee so it sobers you up and you can talk to the police. So I ordered a cup of coffee from my buddy Dave. And it did not have the desired effect. Dave threw up down the stainless steel counter. And as it turns out, if you're looking for Louisville City policemen at midnight, the best place to find them is at the White Castle. So two of them came down and said, "What's the matter with your buddy?" I said, "He's just had a little bit too much to drink." "Really? Well, how old is he?" 14. "How old are you?" 14. So I was in Louisville City Jail 4 hours after my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you my drinking problem started my last 2 years. During those 2 years, I was living in a basement apartment down in Atlanta, and really wasn't paying my rent, but because it was rented originally by the corporation I was working for, and I had a good job when I came here. I didn't have any furniture in it, instead of living on the street, I was living on the floor of my bathroom, and I would come to, and I would try to get a drink down. I would dry heave, and then I would get some whiskey down, straight whiskey, because anything with water made me sick. I didn't have any food, and I kept a Sara Lee cheesecake and would occasionally have a piece of that. But basically, I went without any food for the last 2 years. And all I did was bleed every time I got sick. And the only trips I made were up to the liquor store to get a bottle. And eventually, you get evicted. And so when I got here, I was without a home. But here's what happened the first 3 times I took a drink. The first time I take a drink, I come from a family where nobody that I know of had been arrested. Nobody I know of had shamed the family that way. And I get arrested, and my dad was not happy, and the only thing I can think of was, when can I have that next drink? Because all I thought about was the way I felt until I got arrested. The second time I drank was, we just moved to this new school, and I was playing football, JV football, and the I was a starting quarterback, so the older guys kind of sponsored me in, and they got me something to drink for a party that at that school. And it was what I would recommend if you're going to have a slip, cherry vodka. And the next time I drank, one of the older kids got me some straight whiskey. And that's what I drank, Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey, until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, unless I couldn't get that, and then I would drink anything. The same thing, and the only reason that I did that each time, none of it tasted good, it was because of the effect that I got. Not because of what it did for me, it was because of the effect that I got from that alcohol. Same thing that happened during that 3 months. I was in love with, infatuated with, absolutely obsessed with this girl who was my girlfriend. I didn't really have anybody close that I was intimate with, but I was intimate with this girl, not in the way we talk about intimate, not biblically intimate. I mean, I was intimate so that we actually shared with each other. She was a wonderful girl. And when she found out about me getting locked up that first time, she said, you know, I haven't told you this, but my dad is alcoholic, and when he drinks, he gets mean, and it's not pretty, and for that reason, I really need to ask you not to drink while we're going out. And it took me less than 24 hours to break up with the only person in my life that I had a real relationship with. That's how important alcohol was to me early on. But I can tell you that I didn't even realize that till I'd been here and gotten all the... Because we come in with blinders. I had no idea. It was several house cleanings before I even got to that. That's what's so crazy about this disease. It tells you you don't have it. So, from that point on, when I drank, I started drinking as much as I could, whenever I could. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been arrested 22 times. I was arrested once for kind of a DUI here in Atlanta. I was also drag racing a friend of mine the wrong way on West Peachtree, and I was the one that pulled over when the cops came up behind us, and so it was kind of drunk driving, but it was also, I was just going the wrong way on a, you know, whatever. And so, and I paid a guy $2,000. This was 38, 39 years ago. I paid guys $2,000. A guy that we used to call Disco Darrell, who, anyway, doesn't make any difference. That's a different story. But he had been attached to the district attorney's office, and so that was before computers, so apparently I never got that ticket. So that's the only time I ever got locked up for a DUI. Every other one of the 22 times was not. I found out later you could make money for things that you got arrested for. You could sell things, steal things, do things like that. Not me. Every arrest that was made for me was made for defiance. It's the defining characteristic of everybody in this room when they walk in here. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. And that's exactly what happened. As soon as I started drinking, nobody was going to tell me what to do. I got arrested 6 times my senior year in high school. I got arrested at my senior prom for 2 counts of assault and battery on a police officer. When I drank, I was funny. I was really funny for a while. I was quiet at first, then I got really funny, and then there was just something that was bugging me. And so I tended to lash out at very large people, or usually authority figures, with somebody with a uniform on. People say, why do you do that? And I said, don't know. But that's what I did. That's my idea of fun, and I got arrested 21 times that way. Now, because of the way I acted and because of the parents that I came from, who were very good parents, but they said, we don't want you behaving like that and staying here. They're trying to tell me don't behave like that. But what I took was don't stay here. So I moved out, got an apartment with some older kids when I was in high school. I worked hard. I worked extra hours and everything so I could pay for my rent. I paid for my rent and for an Austin Healey and for an old one, for my booze when I was in high school. If I'd worked that hard at actually doing something constructive, you know, but I paid so I had the freedom to drink, and I had this apartment with these other kids. So my parents often didn't know where I was. Now, I didn't break off with them. I would go home and emotionally blackmail my mother to try to get something. You know how we are. And, you know, it was years before I realized the worst thing that I ever did when I was drinking was tear the hearts out of my mom and dad because they were good people. But I hadn't even thought about that. I thought about all the sensational things I did, but not tearing the hearts out of my mom and dad because there was so much promise for me. I was a kid who made good enough grades in high school. I could have gone to Brown, Harvard, Yale, whatever, up until my junior and senior year. And then by the time I got out, I had been arrested so many times, it took my uncle to help me get into the University of Kentucky, which was a state school. So I'm now at my senior prom. My parents, normally this would be a proud day for them. They take pictures of you when you go to the prom. It's a wonderful thing. My parents don't know where I am, but they found out the next morning because I was on ABC and NBC and CBS News. Those were the only three channels. There was no CNN. There wasn't anything else. This was Louisville, Kentucky, and at the same time we have the prom night, we have that same weekend, we have something, a little horse race called the Kentucky Derby. So I was locked up on Derby Eve. Now, I went to high school with two black kids, and I got along with both of them. One of them played football with me, so I thought I knew all about race relations. But I was locked up that night. I'm over 18, so it's not a juvie. It's a full thing. It's assault battery on a police officer, which is a major felony in Kentucky. And so they throw me in with the other felons, and there are eight bays. And the next morning, me and my seven roommates, inmates, whatever you want to call us, get to go out. And that's where everybody in my family found out where I was after being arrested at the prom, because I had been locked up and put in a cell with seven Black Panthers who were in Louisville, Kentucky, to blow up Churchill Downs as a statement for civil rights. I'm not sure how that works, but anyway. And so I walk out. So the next morning on ABC, CBS, and NBC News, there are seven Black Panthers and me in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. And this is where the benefits of having alcohol control my life come in, because the other kids didn't get to go to places like that. You know, I was chairman of the breakfast committee that night for the prom. I didn't get to go to all that, but I thought, you know, everybody gets to go to that. I got to hang out with the Black Panthers. So, and I started rationalizing this. I mean, we rationalize the way we think. You know, and I am a writer. I was a writer when I was young. It says you can either sing or you can't sing. You write or you can't write. So I was a writer. I was always doing things on the newspaper and stuff. So I'm going to be a writer like Hemingway. Hemingway sat and drank and ran with the bulls and, you know, Fitzgerald. I didn't pay attention to the fact that Hemingway, you know, shot himself in the head with a shotgun at some point when things weren't going all that well. And Fitzgerald died of an overdose, and Tennessee Williams choked to death on his, you know, medicine, the cap of his pill container. I didn't pay attention to the results that these guys got. I just thought, these are guys, they're sensitive. We are sensitive. I feel more than a regular person, so I just have sometimes have to kind of sedate my feelings and so you can rationalize anything you want to if you want to drink. I mean, you don't need help with that. So that's the way I was. I go off. I went to the University of Kentucky for a little while. I never finished anything. After I started drinking, I would go with somebody for a little while, but I always had another girlfriend lined up because I knew I was going to foul that one up, or another job. I go to UK. One night we're sitting there. Somebody had just brought in a TAC, tape-to-tape, reel-to-reel tape deck. That was new back then. And it was, you know, before that we had record players. So we're listening. We recorded ourselves that night. And I heard it the next day. And we were talking about going to Vietnam, how all our parents had been in World War II, and we didn't want to miss out on this. And so, you know, and I said, you know, but I was the only one that got up, started drinking again, and went down and visited a recruiter and ended up at boot camp. The rest of them just thought, well, that was an interesting conversation. But I show up. So I show up. Now I go off to Vietnam twice. I put in for Key West because they had a detachment down there. Key West, Key West, and Key West. I got Vietnam, and the Pentagon. So I go off to Vietnam, and honestly, I know that many of you think of Kentucky as the cutting edge of hip, but I actually never saw a joint in high school or college, and this is in the 60s. So, you know, our drink was Rebel Yell, which was whiskey with a Confederate flag on it, and you do the knit-knit after you take a drink, and that was it. And so I go off, and I go to Vietnam. Now, there's where I saw people were doing drugs. And I always thought, and then I had been the lower companion in high school and in college. But now, here's a group of people that I can kind of look down on. Because, as I said, I felt like you lacked self-discipline if you did drugs. And I'm not saying that I didn't smoke a few joints or accidentally do LSD on a plane ride one time. But The Wild Turkey 101 became my drug of choice, and that's what I continued with. And so I actually did okay. I think it's probably because of the gene pool. I did okay in combat. I made it to E6 or Staff Sergeant real quick in about 3 years, mostly because the people ahead of me were going home early. And bags. And so I go through this, but I come back and I get to the Pentagon. Now, we're not going off on, you know, a patrol or a mission and coming back and getting drunk. Those guys to work every day. They have their first meeting is 8 o'clock. They're generals, so they want to talk to somebody at a breakfast meeting at 5:30 or 6. I'm coming in drunk at 4, so I can only get an hour's sleep, and I go there. So I realize that I'm the one person in our family that's not going to have a military career. Everybody else is retired, not me. So I went into the reserve, but I transferred back to my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. The guy that I drank with, who was my drinking buddy, was married to a girl named Bunny, and upstairs lived this beautiful girl. I was engaged 6 times before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And nobody ever actually married me, but I was engaged 6 times. And I was very charming until you got to know me. And so so this girl, and they all look like somebody I saw in the movies, because everything about my life, the same year that I decided to go off to UK, I saw The Graduate 10 times. And I made it all the way through school without smoking. I started smoking and had an affair with an older woman. And she'd be about 89 now. And so... But I don't know how to live out here, but I know how to live in the film, and I relate to these students, and I'm relating to the actors. I know what they're doing, and that's real to me. And so I continue that all the way through. So this girl looked like Olivia Newton-John, and I know some of you are young here, but everybody that I got engaged to was a hottie. She looked like somebody that was a movie star, and Olivia Newton-John was a real hottie in those days. And the film Xanadu, I think, had just come out or something. So I'm in love with her. I'm just absolutely, I got a job in an ad agency. I'm writing and producing commercials. I'm very good at what I do. I don't have to do it very long during the day either. I would come in and tell them I was working at home, and I worked for about 2 hours a day, but I was just good and quick and got my job done. I won a bunch of awards. I got promoted, made more money. She and I are going to get married. We just need to figure out what to do with her husband. And he was an attorney for the Nixon administration, and Nixon was running for re-election. And he was out on the road as an advance man for Nixon. And this is really good. I just was Googling doing something on Facebook the other day. I try not to get too involved. I really don't want anybody knowing what I'm doing, but I can check up on my sponsees. And so I was on Facebook, and I looked, and this guy is in Louisville, Kentucky. I have access to him. I have never apologized to him for kind of taking over his marriage before he left it. But and I guess I'm supposed to do that. We'll see. But anyway, that was one of those things. The guy was such a, you know, jerk. I just thought it excluded me from making amends, but I may have missed that one. So anyway, but this guy, you know, I'm trained. I was an expert marksman when I was on active duty. So, you know, we went after each other a few times. I went after him with a shotgun. He was an attorney. He came after me with a warrant. So, you know, different training. And so, but you know, we have willpower. So I stuck in there and stuck in there and stuck in there until I got her out of this bad marriage. And we're engaged, and we're going to get married on May the 20th. And it was like May the 10th or somewhere around there. And we had separate apartments because, we're going to wait till but we stayed together a lot. And so I was a daily drinker in high school. I drank Country Club malt liquor before homeroom. I drank at lunchtime. I started drinking whiskey in the afternoon. I was tending bar at Dutch's Tavern, which was the local tavern, when I was a junior and senior in high school. I'd been drinking there so long. So when my buddies would come in who were 17 or 18, I would have to card them. And they'd say, what the? So anyway, that's where my whole entire life was. So we're getting ready to get married. But in addition to the daily drinking, I always had this thing where I would now and then go on a binge. Daily drinkers, my experience, don't have a lot of blackouts because we're always in the gray, but not black, not white. We're just kind of foggy. But I would go on binges on top of that, and then I would lose a day or two. And I had gone on one of these, apparently. I don't think I did anything bad, but I didn't know where I was. And this was 10 days before the wedding, and she got nervous, and she said, why don't we postpone this wedding for a while? I need to see what's happening. When you don't show up for a day or two, that concerns me. Now, anybody today, I would think that as something, well, yes, we need to work on that. But anybody that rejected me at all, and I just left. That's the way I dealt with any kind of problem in life. I just left. So she had cast me out and thrown me away, and the wedding was off. And so I was trying. The one thing I thought about when I was rejected like that was not, did I do something wrong? It was, how can I make me feel better? Well, I was already drinking as much as I could. I didn't do very well on drugs. And so I thought, well, what can I do that will make me feel better? And in Vietnam, they gave us certain beers we hadn't had before, and there was also a magazine I hadn't seen before, and it was called Penthouse. And Penthouse had things in it that I'd never seen before, and they had I'm a smart guy, and they had an intellectual section called the Forum, or Letters section, where they have these different philosophical ideas about how we relate to each other. And so I had read in there, and my buddies and I would read, and there was a concept in there called a menage a trois. And obviously we didn't know French when we were over there either, which we were in French in China. We didn't really, there wasn't a lot we did know. But anyway, so I remembered this concept. I had actually brought it up on several occasions with my fiance, but her having formerly been married to a Nixon aide, she was a little conservative, so she wasn't going for that. And so now I'm cast out, I'm hurt, I'm trying to make myself feel better, and so I go looking for a menage a trois, and that's how I describe it, in Louisville, Kentucky, about 40 years ago, and Louisville was not. We didn't even know what gay people were. So I'm looking for this place now. I bring this up because this is the kind of trouble you can get into without a sponsor. In that book, in Penthouse, and honestly, this was a different world. Today you can go online and see a zebra having a relationship with a couple of teenagers or whatever. But when I was growing up, the closest thing I had to pornography was the tribal section of National Geographic. So this is like information that nobody's going to know about, nobody talks about, and I'm going to have this menage, and so I'm looking for a place to have a menage, and if I want to have a menage, I'm going to have it, and I would like for the two girls to like each other. So there was another concept in there called lesbian. And so now I'm looking for a lesbian bar where I can find two women that want to be with me in Louisville, Kentucky 40 years ago. And if you're not sure what's wrong with that, keep coming back. So, and who do you ask? Because I lived in an apartment where we all knew each other. There were 11 of us, and we had to have a reference to get in there. We were buddies. It was Marine Corps, Army, Navy. We had all the flags out on Sunday. Whoever got up first rang the bell, opened a keg, and we started playing volleyball out there. If you were married, and weren't fighting, you'd all be out there together. If you had a stayover, you'd bring her out to introduce her to all your alcoholic friends. It was a great life. So I'm trying to find this place, and there was at this ad agency where I'm working, there's a art director, a guy in the back, and he keeps, I understand you're looking for a lesbian bar. I said, yeah. I said, I wonder how he would know. So anyway, and he says, well, there's, and he gave me the address. So I go over to this place, and I walk in, and there's nobody in there. There's a woman at the bar, a piano bar, and a guy playing the piano, and I'm drinking. I smoked 4 packs of L&M's a day in those days. That's what I started smoking after the graduate. I'm drinking, 3 shots of Wild Turkey. Neat, water bruises the flavor. And so I'm getting, and nothing's happening. There's nothing going on, and I'm having a good conversation with this woman, but I can tell there's not going to be any menage. So all of a sudden, up there across the floor, the dance floor, there was a staircase going up, but a door opened up, and something must have been going on upstairs, and down, like in a slow-motion movie, and it was like Loretta Young. And this was another TV show that you have to Google if you're young, but it was a beautiful woman who would cascade down these stairs in this long dress, and she comes floating down. Well, this was a beautiful redhead. I don't know what color Loretta Young's hair was because it was black and white, but this was a beautiful redhead that just came. Our eyes met, and we just kind of got to the middle of the dance floor. We're holding on to each other. We start making out. We kissed each other, and we're absolutely in love. When you're in love, you kiss a few times, and then you take 3 feet over this way, and you want to start kissing again because you don't want it to go away. You want to make sure it's real. And so then the mission came, and I said, by the way, do you have a girlfriend that we could invite to join us tonight? And her name was Erica, and she said, why don't we get to know each other tonight, and tomorrow night we'll have somebody. I just said, thank God I did not marry that Republican woman. So now we're dancing, we're going back. This is my hometown. It's 4th Street downtown where we all went for the clubs and the theaters and stuff. And we're going back to my place. I'm thinking, this is one beautiful redhead. This is going to be, she's going to look great tomorrow at the pool. And drugs rears its ugly head one more time. Erica pulls out a pill big enough to choke a horse, which was actually a horse tranquilizer called Quaalude, and said, "Would you care for one?" And I said, "No thanks, I don't do drugs." So I took a couple more hits off my wild turkey, and two things happened. Erica passed out, and I found some equipment I definitely wasn't looking for. And after 3 or 4 days, I said, "This is not right." This is the point at which Opie and Wally fail, because I had never seen them deal with this in any episode. So it wasn't long after that, I get fired from that job. Obviously, my love life wasn't going all that well. And so I have managed to get from that agency, which was the biggest agency in the region, a 115-year-old advertising agency, I had won enough awards and stuff, I got a job with the world's biggest ad agency up in New York. So I leave there and I go to New York. And now I'm not going to have this provincial town that doesn't think big enough for me, and I'm a star and I'm going up to New York. That's what I'm thinking up here. While I'm getting fired from that job, I'm going up to that job. They put me in a suite at the Plaza. And then I had a hotel that's down here where they had a suite that they put us up in when I came down here to visit the Coca-Cola headquarters. I started writing and producing the Coca-Cola advertising. And the work that I did was very good. You know, short time, but good head, think up something. You know, I won some Clios. I did a spot that they had with a football player and a kid, and so I'm getting all kinds of rewards. I'm getting more money than I ever thought I would make. And but I'm beginning to lose control of my kidneys and bowels if somebody says something real funny or if I sneeze. And so I'm guarded in my social interaction with people. And so I'm hiding out all the time. And so I would go to work, get my work done, until one day I'm sitting in there recording some music. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. And there were four computers, and we had a lot of singers, a lot of musicians. And I couldn't talk. You know, I drank too much, or I didn't have enough to drink. I don't know what happened, but I couldn't talk. And I went around the corner to a little bar, and there was a guy, and he poured me a triple. And I thought, you know, he doesn't even know me. I haven't said anything, but he poured me a triple. And I shook it all over the bar, and then he poured me another one. And I remembered a film that I'd seen called Lost Weekend with Ray Milland, where I used a lever, and I got it up to my mouth, and I ended up getting it down, and I got another one down. And it eased me off so I could talk, and I could just sit there. And I looked in the mirror, and I didn't recognize myself. I looked like a street drunk, and I was 25 years old. And I wonder what had happened to this kid whose parents had had so much hope for him. I was estranged from my parents by this time. I bumped my dad down after I came back from Vietnam when he wanted me to not go out because he knew I was going out to get another drink. I was staying at their home, so they watched my family watch me knock my dad down. And you know that more than anything else in my life, what here on earth I wanted to do, not just the spiritual thing I wanted to do, but it was to have my dad be proud of me. I did everything to prevent that. So they didn't fire me up there. They punished me by sending me to Atlanta. So I come down here to Atlanta. Now I'm no longer working on the big commercials. I'm working on the Coca-Cola bottler, you know, 2 6-packs for a, you know, whatever it was. Anyway, it was a demotion, and they didn't change my pay, but they sent me down here. And I might as well not have been here. It was a short time before I was in that apartment, and I was drinking and passing out and coming to, and drinking and passing out and coming to. And eventually you get evicted after you don't pay the rent. And I have been evicted. And I go up to the liquor store to get a... I've been writing bad checks the whole time. And I go up to the store to get a bottle, and said, "Just a minute." He brought out the owner, and the owner says... I just remember that owner, the last time I talked here, was in this audience. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous now. But the owner said, "We know that check you're writing is no good and hasn't been good for a long time, and we need you not to come in here anymore." And as humiliating as that was, the only thought I had was, "Oh God, I hope he gives me that whiskey," and he did. And I walked around the corner, and I was getting ready to open up and take a drink, and almost in slow motion, that bottle fell out and hit the concrete and busted, and I had no place to go. I couldn't live without alcohol. When I got here, I still have what I had when I got here. A pair of yellowish brownish pants, a blue polo shirt, some loafers just like I'm wearing tonight, except with holes in them, and a 45, a 1911 45 that I had in my pocket. Because I got very paranoid my last 2 or 3 years. And so I got angry that I was going to die. I had a bullet in the chamber, and I got ready to pull the trigger, and I started screaming at God because I got so angry that this kid that had all this potential was going to die. And I started yelling, "God, blanket, God, blanket, God, blanket." And something broke, and I said, "God, help me, God, help me, God, help me." And I had a moment of peace, and just like in those old days, God can reach you however you're willing to receive it. I saw that scene from a movie I'd seen 50 times called Days of White Roses, where Jack Klugman walks up to Jack Lemmon and says, "I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous." And I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner, and I didn't have a nickel. And I called the operator, and I was crying. I said, "I think I'm an alcoholic." And somebody who probably went to NAPA and was on a committee for public information had gone to Bell South to tell them about AA and what we do and gave them the number to the central office. And she connected me to the central office, and a year before, a woman had decided to take a job there so she could help alcoholics, and her name was Helen. And Helen is still at central office, if you don't know her. And Helen said, "Honey, I know where you are. I know what's going on. I know I've been through what you're going on. And I need for you to stay right there. I've got somebody that's going to come out." And the guy came out to pick me up. And I was sitting there with a gun on my lap, loaded. And this guy had read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a year and a half sobriety. He had worked for the railroad. He was living in an apartment at the Darlington apartment, one-room apartment with a hot plate. But he had a brand-new car. You know how we are. And so, well, it wasn't much of a car. It was a Pinto, but it would have a sticker on the side of it. And so, but he had read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he knew that this was not about him telling me what to do. He told me about himself, and I began to believe him. And if he could get sober, I could get sober. And so I did the most complete third step I've ever done that day, and I turned my life over to him. And after I did, he got me in the car, and he knew that I was, because I was already vibrating and shaking, "I'm going to take you to a place to dry out, because I don't want you to go into DTs." And I did go into DTs for about 5 days. But when he was taking me, he said, "Just a minute, I need to stop here to use an ATM machine to get $20. Now, apparently I had missed the news. The ATM machines came out that year. So did the Elvis die. Star Wars came out, and ATM machines came out the year that I died. So anyway, the year that I got sober, the year my old me died. And so he said, "You're going to be okay." And I said, "Yes." And while he was up there, it was a hot day in Atlanta, like it's been the last couple of days, and I couldn't get the door open, and I threw up down the inside of his brand new car. And he came out, and the only thing he did was put his arm around me and say, "It's going to be okay." That's the kind of unconditional love that I've received from people in Alcoholics Anonymous since I've been here, because if you come in and you really accept who we are and the great gift that we've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's not a day that I would ever think that anything I did for an alcoholic would be an inconvenience. And so I went with him, turned my entire life over to him, and we go to this place, and I start drying out, and I went into DTs, and there was a little man, we used to call him the ugliest man in AA. His name was Joe Hubbard, and he was a member here, and he was a fixture here, and he was the guy that introduced me, and he actually, I didn't have $5 or whatever it was, but he bought me my first month membership here right then, and he would stay there and put his arm on mine. And when somebody's going through delusions and DTs, if you will, just physical contact brings them out of that delusion. And Joe helped a lot of people get sober. He's a crazy little guy. He smoked all the time, and then when he quit smoking, nobody could smoke. I mean, you know, and he was on an oxygen tank up here at meetings, but that's the way everybody was in the beginning of it. So from that day until now, I have not been without somebody, and usually a lot of somebody, who will do anything and everything to make sure I had the opportunity to stay sober. I was homeless, so while he was buying me a membership at NAB, I was homeless. Something I forgot, you know, I told him that I had lined up someplace to live, but unfortunately they wanted me to pay rent. So I ended up going back to Louisville, Kentucky, my hometown, and thought I would get in there and start off right. And I had brain damage. It took me a year to learn how to read, so nobody's going to hire me as a writer if you can't read or have a discussion with somebody. And so I was scared because I didn't know whether I was going to ever recover. And I remember the very first speaker I ever heard in Atlanta was at the intergroup dinner in June, 2 weeks after I dried out. And a guy got up, and he talked about being so dizzy after a year and a half of sobriety that he had to hold on to a lamp pool. And I knew that he was okay. His name was Chuck Chamberlain. And that was the first outside speaker I ever heard. And he was at the intergroup dinner here. And again, something that Helen was involved in. So they send me up to Louisville. Big Book says if you take the third step, it'll be taken care of. Whatever you need is going to be taken care of. Not your heart's desire and what you wanted in the eighth grade, but everything you need will be taken care of. And I go up there. I got a place to stay in a bunk, and I'm living in a cot, and I help these new drunks to come in because we didn't have a treatment center. When they would come in, I would stay up at night and help them dry out. And we had a doctor who would take care of them, but I would basically give them, you know, this little concoction of some orange juice and honey and stuff that we gave them to help them a little bit. And some, a lot of these guys would get to feeling better and they'd leave. But I stayed sober. And I poured coffee at a place like NABA, except it was called the Token Club, and I was pouring coffee and said they gave me enough money for cigarettes. So I had my room and board of cigarettes just for helping alcoholics. But I got my first job in AA, and that's important if you're here and you don't have a job. The reason that Tim is here and he stays here, and the reason that Larry is here, all these guys are doing stuff for other people all the time. The reason Johnny is always here, he's always doing stuff for other people all the time. And those days, because I had brain damage, they wouldn't let me do anything that required math, like making coffee. And so I ended up, but in Louisville at that time, you came into Alcoholics Anonymous and you didn't smoke. It was mandatory that you learn how to smoke. So by this time of the meeting, I wouldn't be able to see anybody in this room, but we could hear you. And so everybody smoked. And so I was the ashtray guy in my home group. And I had 10 ashtrays, and they were round and blue and gold and red and Christmas tree colors, and they were made out of some corrugated metal where they would fuse with the ashes. And I had a Brillo pad, and I kept them really shiny and good, and I put them out, and I was really proud of being the ashtray guy. That made me feel like I made a contribution to that group. I had more pride in being the ashtray guy for that group than I had in being the youngest creative director they had at this agency up in New York, because I was doing something for people. And then one day I found out about this terrible thing they have called rotation. Rotation is where they won't let one person have the same job all the time because some of us have big egos, apparently, and we want to control things. So they came and they said, we've got a new guy, and he's going to become the ashtray guy. And I said, I don't think so. They said, no. Said, he needs this job to stay sober like you did. I said, you know, they give you that stuff, so what are you going to argue? And so they said, well, we have another job for you. You're going to be the chairman. I said, I'm going to be the chairman? No. The chairman. But AA is fair. There were only 10 ashtrays, and there were 40 chairs, so this is a promotion. So, and that is the way I have service. I've had every job just about you can, except for trustee. I've been your delegate. I've been the area chair. I've been chair of the Atlanta Roundup. I chair the Woodstock of the South that happens in December. I've always got some job. I'm a greeter at my home group. I've got some job, with the exception of between 12 and 15 years of sobriety. And during those 3 years, I decided it was time. That was 20-some-odd years ago, I decided I was going to be get in touch with some of my issues, you know, because I had issues. And so I started doing that, and by the end of the third year, I was suicidal in the hotel room in Los Angeles trying to find a gun so I could put a bullet in my head. And I was fortunate. I cried out to God again, and I got back in the middle of stuff. And my experience is that I am much better when I'm being useful to people than when I'm dealing with my issues. My issues may still be there when I die, but I'll be sober because I'm helping people. So now I go through this, and they told me from the very beginning, I know I'm going to go over a couple of minutes, I hope that's okay. They told me from the very beginning that the fellowship is not the program. The program is working the 12 steps. And so they kept having me work through the steps, and I didn't have anybody I really resented my first year, but I had brain damage, I couldn't remember anything. So when I finally got to a root cause inventory, I hated everybody. I resented everybody, because you had the power over me. The women that didn't want to go out with me, or that didn't want to marry me, or whatever it was, you had the power over me. And the guys that had more money, or they had a bigger motorcycle, or a bigger sports car, or whatever it was, they had the power, or whatever it was. Everybody except me had power. And here's the secret of the universe. I did actual graduate study in intercultural studies and didn't find this out. There is one who has all power. That one is God. We read it every day at these meetings. If God has all power, you don't have any power. You can't mess my life up because you don't have the power. Well, that's the good side. The downside is I don't have any power. But according to what I read in that book, if I will do what my Father says, we had a new employer, keep close to him, and if we do what he says, he provides everything I need. My spiritual Father will give me everything because he's the creator and has everything in this universe. So whatever I need, I will be given, if I just do what my Father wants me to do. So that means I got to find out what my Father wants me to do. I got to find out what God's will is. That's all this program is. It seems like it's real simple, but I don't know why it's so difficult. But that's the thing. So suddenly I learned that by working through these, making amends, and that's where the big awakening comes. Making amends, and I go back to this Baptist church that I had walked down the aisle and blamed for so long because of God rejecting me. And two things happened. One, I found a group of people that weren't at all who I thought they were. I read a book that didn't say what I thought it said. And I was accepted there just as well as I am here. And my life started to open up, and I realized if I'm a child of God, I'm not just a child of God in AA. The second thing that happened was I met a beautiful blonde who was there, who was two things I definitely wasn't looking for. She was a good girl and a seminary student. I was kind of looking for a new dancer who needed spiritual help. And so, but because I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, that girl who was a seminary student is no longer in that. She's been in the treatment field for about 30 years, but she and I have been married for 30 years, and she's at home, and she's praying for me right now. And she's as active in Al-Anon as I am in AA, and we're still married. And I'm a guy who never could even get somebody married. Everything that I have ever looked for, everything that I've ever wanted in life, was given to me if I was willing to first do, this is a word none of us like, be obedient. Do what my father wanted me to do. If I do what my father wants me to do, he'll give me. So I go through this, I'm having this, my last, I got three stories and I'll close. I had my last of those amends that I made was to a church I had actually defaced when I was in high school. And it's the church where we buried my dad in January. And I go to this place and I'm going to make amends and I go in, I can't find anybody. And I go down to the chapel and there's nobody in there. And I started praying and all of a sudden I realized every day I was asking God to keep me sober and thanking God at night. And I didn't trust God. I thought God had been angry. I thought God was unfair. And I had all kinds of mixed feelings about God. And this love-hate relationship with God. And so I got down on my knees and I started forgiving God. I had forgiven people who were jerks, who didn't deserve it, because I was told to. But I was still holding grudge against God. And so I started forgiving God. I had the most powerful experience I'd had to, in my life to that date where I felt like I weighed nothing and there was a breeze that was actually blowing through my heart. And there, all this weight fell off my back. And for the first time ever, we call this recovery, but I don't think it is. I think it's the first time we do stuff like this. I had never had a relationship with God like this. And suddenly, I'm free. And I'm having a spiritual awakening, and I realize I'm a child of God, and I've got access to my Father, and I've got this new life going on, and I go to a retreat with a bunch of men. And the group that I ran with, and the guys that I'm still with, we do an annual house cleaning, because the big book says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be maximum service to God and the people about us. Not do it once, sit back and rest on our laurels, but continue to grow. I hope I'm a lot better person 5 years from now than I am now. And continue to grow. So we would go to this retreat. We went to it at Gethsemane, which was a Trappist monastery, not because everybody was Catholic, because it was a nice place to go, quiet. And we went in February when it was very quiet, snow outside. And I go, and this priest comes in and he says, "You boys are always looking for God's will." And that's exactly what I was looking for. I had this spiritual awakening. I'm one of God's kids, like you. What do I do? What is this? And so he said, "God's will is this simple. Do the best you can right now with what you've got. If you're a brother, be a good brother. If you're a son, be a good son. If you're a father, be a good father. If you have a job that you love and you're good at it, do it honorably until God gives you something else. If you have a job that you hate and can't stand, do it honorably and love people through that job until God gives you something else." He said, God loves us, his kids, the same way we love our kids. And if you men had two boys, both 6 years old, and he gave each one of them a red wagon, and one of them took that red wagon around the neighborhood and spread joy, and the other one kicked it aside and said, "I want a scooter," who would you give more to? I had always been the person that had given the gift, but I took it, kicked it aside, and didn't want it anymore. And all I had to do was be grateful for what I had and start using it for other people, and my life would change. It's not always easy to live that way. It's great to live that way and be grateful for what you have when things are going well, but in 2005, and this is the last story I'll close with, 2005, my wife and I had this dog, was 18 years old, an elk hound named Booger Bear, and Booger Bear was sick. He's 18, he was only supposed to live to be 12, and we were keeping him here, I think, longer than we needed to. And we had to put him to sleep, and we were crying and thought this is the worst thing that could ever happen. And within 3 months, Barbara's mom and dad, for whom we were the caretakers, they had Alzheimer's, died within a week of each other unexpectedly, and my mom died about a month later. So we lost 3 out of 4 parents, our dog, and we go off to Toronto, to the International, which I hope all of you will attend here. And I've been to seven of them. They're tremendous. And I would go off to Toronto, and I come back, and I go to a physical, and I'm told that I have esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer is 99% fatal. You just never see anybody that lives from it. And those who do live from it have a lot of problems. It's only one more fatal than pancreatic cancer or liver cancer. So I'm reading. I can't tell my wife because she's just lost her mom and dad and our dog, who's more like a child to us. And because I can't tell my wife, I can't tell you because you don't gossip. And so the only people that knew were my prayer partner, Keith Lewis, another prayer partner, Ed Mutum, my sponsor, my sister who was helping me, and the doctors that were helping me. And I find the right place. It's a treatment out in the University of Southern California, and they remove all of your, everything in your chest, all the lymph nodes, your upper esophageal system, all of that. Two-thirds of your stomach is taken out. They replace it and build a new digestive system. You're on a feeding tube for a year or two. It's this tremendous thing. It's uncomfortable and all this, but you can live. And people were living and having a healthy life and all this stuff, and they were doing this. And I'm ready to go out there, and we're all connected. And they call back and said, we can't take your insurance. But if you can put $500,000 into an equity account here, we can handle it. Well, I'm not a good money manager, and we didn't have $500,000. And I'm going down to speak in Key West, and I take one of my great, I think it was somebody that Johnny was sponsored with me. And I'm getting angrier and angrier as we're going down there. I'm supposed to speak on Saturday night, and I'm going to die because God can't arrange for me to have the right kind of insurance. And I started praying, and a friend of mine down there that I shared with said, well, whenever I can't connect, I couldn't connect with God. I just say whatever I remember, and I remember the 23rd Psalm from memorizing it for the third grade PTA, and I started saying, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And on and on. And I just gave, right before the meeting, I got up and I remembered my first sponsor in Louisville, Kentucky. And he was one of those smokers, and he'd gotten lung cancer and it spread to his brain. And I talked to him the day he came out of the doctor's office, said he had 6 malignant brain tumors. And he was, and then I said, you mean you got ready to go? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I don't hear any fear. He said, if God is this good to his ear, just imagine what he's got waiting on the other side. And the big book says, promises that we will lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. I can't just pick and choose what promises I believe in. And so I relaxed. And if I was going to paradise, which was the worst thing that could happen to me, then it was a good thing. And God would take care of my wife. And whatever was going to take place, I accepted. And I got up and I talked and I shared that. And people came up. It was like down in the Keys. And there were all these guys down there that had all kinds of cancer. And they come up and one miracle after another. And I come back up here and I expected to... You know, California was going to call and say, God called us, and he said you could come. But instead, they called me and they said, we still can't help you, but the chief of surgery here, who actually perfected this, is now in Rochester, New York. Why don't you call him? So we called him on Monday morning. He already had the labs and the film, and within an hour he called back and he said, can you get up here? Can you leave for here tomorrow? He said, I don't care about your insurance, but I need to teach this procedure to some people. And so if you can come up as quickly as you can, I'd like to go into surgery 3 days from now. And so now I've got to tell Barbara, who didn't know, and she's now upset, but I, you know, some things you can't help. So we go on up there, and especially concerned about being in Rochester, New York, and not knowing anybody. But because I've been active, we got up there, and there were 23 people that somebody had called. And they're standing outside the hotel when we got there. We had a new home group in Al-Anon and AA, and they helped do our laundry and everything else. They took us to a meeting that night, and the next day we go to the hospital, and we walk into the chapel to pray before I meet the doctor. And on the wall, in letters that were 1.5 feet deep in gold, it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And when they go out to the lobby, and it says, to see where God had brought us. And we were at Strong Memorial Hospital, endowed by the family of Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, who had helped start the Alcoholic Foundation, without whom I wouldn't have been here in the first place. My experience is this. It doesn't make any difference what you're going through. Cancer, a hurricane, somebody broke into your house and stole everything. That's not who we are or what makes us worth anything. We are connected to a power greater than us that we find when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and all we have to do, even if we don't understand it, is take the hand of the person in front of us, grab somebody behind us, and if you stay in this program and you stay in the middle of it, you have more power than you can imagine and all you'll ever need for a great life. And everything that I ever wanted, I wanted people to love me and care for me. When I am useful to other people, they love me and they care for me. It's not a bigger trick than that, just being useful. And I hope that you find the same kind of life. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. I, too, called Helen today, and she already had another engagement, and she sent her love to you, and she wanted me to tell you that.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.